Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loans subject to approval in available locations.
Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shaped the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisiscle.com/podcast.
Okay, welcome back to Behind the Knife. Our Absite series continues with part two of hepatobiliary. Like I mentioned before, we had published our Absite companion. We're looking to potentially add to our content this year, so if anybody has any ideas for topics for the Absite, please reach out. You can reach us at btkpodcast@gmail.com or reach us on Twitter or Facebook. Okay, good. Take it away, Jason.
All right, let's jump right back into it. So we're going to start off with some hepatobiliary lesions. We'll start off with cystic lesions first. So, when I say colloidal cyst, what comes to mind? What are those? Tell us a little bit about them.
Yeah, so colloidal cysts, their etiology is unknown, but it's likely secondary to an anomalous biliary pancreatic duct junction that can generate reflux of pancreatic enzymes. And so these patients also tend to have a long, common BP duct. Most of these are identified and treated in early childhood. They can cause pain, biliary obstruction, and cirrhosis. Overall, you can break them apart into the Todani classification. And we'll go through these. There's 1 through 5.
Okay, so let's just go through these systematically. So this is, again, the Todani classification for colloidal cyst. As Wu said, typically in childhood, not really sure why they happen, but it's that if they had to put your money on something, it'd be that anomalous biliopancreatic duct with a long common BP duct, and there's reflux up and it causes these cysts. So, type 1 colloidal cyst, what is that?
So, type 1 is a fusiform dilation of the extrahepatic biliary tree.
Okay, and how do you treat those?
With resection and a hepaticojejunostomy.
Now, we should have mentioned it, but aside from, you know, these potentially being symptomatic and causing obstruction, why do you have to resect these?
They carry malignant potential.
Correct. Okay, so type 1, fusiform dilation of the extrahepatic biliary tree, resect hepaticoj for that. Kevin, type 2, what's a type 2 colloidal cyst?
So this is the saccular diverticulum of the common bile duct.
Okay, and how do you treat that?
I think of it as like a little appendix coming off. And so for this, you can generally just excise it. But then a lot of times you need to do a Roux-en-Y biliary enteric reconstruction.
Yep. So these are a diverticulum in the common bile duct, you excise the cyst, and you'll likely have to do some form of reconstruction with that. Woo, type 3 colloidal cyst.
So type 3 is also called the colloidal seal. It's a dilation of the intramural duct. You can approach these transduodenally and do a transduodenal excision with sphincteroplasty.
Yep. So colloidal seal, it's the intramural duct. So you do a transduodenal approach and either excise or you do a sphincteroplasty. Okay. So type 4 is broken up into two. There's 4A and 4B. Kevin, what's a type 4A and then what's a type 4B?
So the 4A is multiple dilations of both the intra and extrahepatic ducts. For the 4A, you do a hepatic resection and a biliary reconstruction with a hepaticojejunostomy.
Yep, so do hepatic resection of the involved segments, and then do your biliary reconstruction. Okay, 4B?
And the 4B is just multiple dilations of the extrahepatic ducts alone. Mm-hmm. And so you do an excision with hepaticojejunostomy.
Yep, so again, 4A is dilations of the intra and extrahepatic ducts. 4B is the extrahepatic ducts alone. Okay, woo, type 5.
So 5, by contrast, you have dilation of only the intrahepatic ducts. This is also known as Caroli's disease, and these you treat with transplant.
Okay. And there are cases where you can attempt a partial resection if only one part of the liver is mostly affected. But yeah, I think the board answer is going to be transplantation for type 5. Okay. So those are colidocal cysts. Moving on to the liver. So a simple hepatic cyst. Again, seeing more and more of these as we have everybody gets a CT scan. So what do you do with these?
Simple hepatic cyst with no concerning features on imaging. You can just do nothing if it's asymptomatic. If you aspirate these, they will definitely come back. There's 100% recurrence rate. Sometimes if patients are very symptomatic from a very large cyst or multiple cysts, you see sometimes a polycystic liver disease. You can do laparoscopic cyst fenestration for these symptomatic cysts, and then you should always send the capsule for pathology.
Yep. So it's a small hepatic cyst. Don't worry about them. Don't have to do anything. The larger symptomatic ones, cyst fenestration is going to be the answer. Just make sure you rule out other pathologies like abscess, hydatid cyst, or malignancy. If there's any concern for that, you need an aspiration. You need to get your diagnosis first. Okay. So let's move on to some hepatobiliary, some more solid tumors. So these will come up. A lot of times this is great questions for using imaging of showing you a CT scan or an MRI and then asking you how to treat that. So as we go through these, if you don't know what they look like on imaging, you should Google it and find out. Let's start off with the most common hemangioma. Tell us a little bit about those.
Yeah, so hemangiomas are, again, the most common liver tumor. They have a male predominance and they have equal distribution in the liver. They are congenital vascular malformations. They're generally asymptomatic, but when they do have symptoms, they can cause pain, compressive symptoms. Rarely, they can cause hemorrhage, inflammation, and coagulopathy. This is actually known as the Kasebach-Merritt syndrome.
And what is that Kasebach-Merritt syndrome exactly?
So this is a consumptive coagulopathy that occurs secondary to a large hemangioma.
Right, a consumptive coagulopathy. Okay, what do hemangiomas look like on a CT scan?
Classically, these have a hypodense appearance in the pre-contrast phase. In the arterial phase, they have peripheral central enhancement. And then in the delayed series, they show persistent contrast.
Okay. Yep. Those are key words there, especially that peripheral central enhancement on arterial phase of the CT for hemangioma. Okay. How about on MRI?
On MRI, these are going to be hypointense on T1 and hyperintense on T2.
Okay. And treatment?
So for asymptomatic hemangiomas, observation. What about regardless of size?
Okay. Is there a risk of rupture? Won't these patients bleed to death?
So not for hemangiomas.
Yep, hemangiomas, no. So if they're asymptomatic, no matter how large and scary they look, you can leave them alone. Okay, for symptomatic, what do you do?
So you resect symptomatic hemangiomas.
Okay. Kevin, moving on to the next is another very common one, FNH, or the focal nodular hyperplasia. It's the second most common liver tumor. Who does it affect, and how does it behave?
So yeah, we generally see this in women between the ages of 30 and 50. These are generally completely benign, and they're usually asymptomatic and found on just incidentally on imaging.
Okay, and on imaging, what do they look like on CT scan?
So thankfully, these have a nice buzzword for us that really helps us out, but they're well demarcated. They have rapid arterial enhancement, and they have the central stellate scar.
Yep, the FNH with the central stellate scar on CT is classic. Okay, on MRI?
On MRI, they're hypointense with a central scar on T1, and then they're isointense with hyperintense scar on T2.
Yep. And again, there's buzzwords associated with each of these. Definitely know those, but be aware that they could just show you an image and not use any of these buzzwords. So it's not enough just to know the buzzwords. You have to know what it looks like. So for FNH, what's the treatment?
You don't do anything for these.
Okay. As you mentioned before, they're completely benign, no malignant potential, no bleeding risk. Okay. So let's move on to adenoma. Tell us about adenomas.
So adenomas are rare. In the question stem, look for OCP use or androgen or steroid use. They have a malignant transformation in 10%. They have a risk of rupture that increases with the size, with 30% risk of spontaneous bleeding if the tumor size is greater than 5 centimeters. They can present with pain, abdominal fullness, abnormal LFTs, or bleeding from rupture.
Yeah, this is one of those things that adenoma, you think, oh, it sounds benign. It sounds not scary. But there is a pretty decent malignant potential and a pretty decent risk of rupture. So these are things you have to take seriously. What do they look like on imaging, on CT scan?
So look for arterial enhancement with washout in the portovenous phase. Additionally, they have a smooth surface with the tumor capsule, and they have a lack of that central scar.
Okay. And on MRI?
On MRI, they're mildly hyperintense on both T1 and T2.
Okay. How do you treat adenomas? We mentioned that there's some complications, so I'm sure you have to do something about them. How do you make that decision?
So if they're small and the patient is on OCPs, you want to stop the OCPs and see if they regress. If they're larger, so 4 centimeters or greater, or they have no regression after stopping OCPs, then you resect these. If the patient presents with rupture, then first line is IR embolization, then recover the patient, and then resect in an elective setting.
Yeah, so it depends on the size and depends on what happens with it. So you have to do something about all of them. If they're small, you can stop the OCPs, and if it completely regresses, okay. If it doesn't regress, or if it's larger than 4 centimeters, that resects. They may give you somebody who has, you know, an adenoma that has already ruptured, and the first step in that is IR embolization.
One quick point to make on an additional radiologic study, if you're helping to differentiate between a focal nodular hyperplasia and adenoma, as the treatment for these is very different. So sometimes they'll do a sulfur colloid scan to determine the difference. And what you'll see in the focal nodular hyperplasia is you'll see that there actually are functioning Kupffer cells that will take up the nuclear radiotide throughout the focal nodular hyperplasia lesion. Whereas in adenomas, you'll see an absence of the nuclear radioisotope taken up throughout the central aspect of the adenoma, and you'll really only see it on the periphery.
Yeah, so you think about that. The adenoma is an overgrowth of certain cell type, so it doesn't have those Kupffer cells. Or if it does, their function is diminished. So they will not take up the sulfur colloid, and FNH will. So that's a great point, Kevin. That's a good way of delineating those two if there's any diagnostic confusion. Okay, so that leads us right into our hepatocellular carcinoma. So what are some risk factors for hepatocellular carcinoma?
Yeah, so think of any sort of inflammation in the liver as a key risk factor for hepatocellular carcinoma. So hep B, hep C, cirrhosis of any cause, any inherited errors of metabolism like hemochromatosis or alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency, as well as aflatoxins.
And how do these look on CT scan?
So on CT, they have a characteristic hypervascular lesion that is hyperintense during the arterial phase and hypodense during the delayed phase.
Okay, so let's say you have a patient that has a CT scan that looks like they have a risk factor, they have a history of hep B, and they have a CT scan that looks like a hepatocellular carcinoma. Do you want to biopsy that?
So these can actually be diagnosed on imaging alone, and biopsy carries significant risk. So in these patients, you do not biopsy.
Well, you say on imaging alone, but what else do you need?
That's right. So having an elevated AFP level can also be helpful in the diagnosis.
Right. So if you have a characteristic lesion on imaging and you have an elevated AFP, you do not need a biopsy. You can make the diagnosis. What's the role of a PET scan in these patients?
There's no role for PET.
Yep. So this is one of the cancers where you do not get a PET scan. Okay. So just some most common. So what's the most common site of metastasis for hepatocellular carcinoma?
The lung.
Okay. Kevin, walk us through some principles of management for this hepatocellular carcinoma.
Right. So in general, you want to resect these if possible. So resection is indicated for cure if it's a solitary mass without major vascular invasion and adequate liver function. So you have to evaluate these patients for, you know, do they have underlying cirrhosis that's complicating this? And then how much of the liver would you have to take out, and how much function would they have once that liver's taken out? Resection is possible, but controversial for limited major vascular invasion or multifocal disease that is resectable.
Okay. And so you mentioned there that you have to have, so it's a lot of things in there. So solitary mass without major vascular invasion and adequate liver function. How do you determine adequate liver function?
So there's a special, I believe it's a CT scan that does, that they can protocol that does feature liver remnant. And this will help give you an idea of how much function the liver has.
Yeah. So you need a volumetric analysis to determine your future liver remnants. So how much future liver remnant is needed?
So the liver has an amazing capability to regenerate. So if there's no cirrhosis, you can take out 75% of the liver, leaving only 25% behind in a healthy, otherwise healthy liver.
And what about if you do have mild cirrhosis?
So a child's A cirrhosis patient, they need 30 to 40% future liver remnant in order to safely resect it.
So let's say you have a patient that looks like they have a resectable lesion, but their future liver remnant isn't just quite enough. Are there options?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can consider preoperative portal vein embolization to try to grow that FLR.
Yeah, exactly. So you do selective selective portal vein embolization with the idea that remaining part of the liver will hypertrophy, and then you'll increase your future liver remnant.
This may be obvious to most people, but you do an embolization of the disease side.
Yes, thank you, Kevin. All right, so let's go through this. Okay, so you have a patient with hepatocellular carcinoma, looks resectable. They have no cirrhosis, or they're a child's A. What are you going to do with that patient?
Here you resect.
Okay, so let's say they have moderate to severe cirrhosis, but they have an early stage, what looks like a resectable lesion.
So this is the patient you would consider for transplantation.
Okay, and are there any criteria for transplantation with hepatocellular carcinoma?
Yes, these patients have to meet the Milan and Yunos criteria. So essentially, they need one lesion less than 5 centimeters, or three or fewer lesions, all less than 3 centimeters, as well as no gross vascular or extrahepatic spread.
Okay, say that one more time, because that's important. So the Milan criteria, what is the Milan criteria?
So one lesion that's less than 5 centimeters, or three or fewer lesions that are all less than 3 centimeters, and no gross vascular or extrahepatic spread.
Okay. Kevin, what about patients who aren't candidates for surgical curative treatments? What are some local regional therapies?
Unfortunately, this ends up being a large majority of patients with hepatocellular carcinoma due to underlying liver conditions. So they should be considered in patients that are not surgical curative treatments. So these are, and sometimes these can be bridges to curative therapy if the tumor responds well. So one of the more common ones is ablation, which can be done by the interventional radiologist through a number of ways. This can be radiofrequency ablation, cryoablation, microwave ablation. These are best for small lesions. And sometimes actually the surgical oncologist will do these in the operating room. Then there's the arterially directed therapies, sometimes called TACE. And these can be considered for unresectable tumors greater than 5 centimeters. And then there's also a role for external beam radiation therapy. These are good for lesions that are not amenable to ablation or TACE due to the tumor location.
Yeah, so that's where you really have to consider, you know, the location of the tumor, if it's near any very, you know, vital structures, and kind of tailoring an approach. And, you know, generally there's very, you know, extensive liver tumor boards that, where everybody meets and kind of goes into a personalized treatment for each patient. But these are just kind of general things that to know for board purposes. Okay, moving out of hepatocellular carcinoma onto cholangiocarcinoma. How do we break up cholangiocarcinoma when thinking about it?
So you want to think about these in the intrahepatic and extrahepatic.
Perfect.
Categories.
And Kevin, what are some risk factors for cholangiocarcinoma?
So primary sclerosing cholangitis, which can be seen in patients with ulcerative colitis, bile duct stones, choledochal cyst, as we discussed earlier. Then there's some more rare things such as liver fluke infections, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, and just anything that causes chronic inflammation of the bile ducts.
Okay. So we said that you want to break it up into intrahepatic and extrahepatic disease because that'll change how you approach it. So how do you want to approach an intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma?
So for here, you want to think about the role of preoperative biopsy. And in an intrahepatic cholangiocarcinomas, pre-op biopsy is not necessary if you have radiographic and clinical evidence that suggests malignancy. So primarily, you would go with a diagnostic laparoscopy first to rule out any disseminated disease. During the time of the diagnostic laparoscopy, you want to look for lymph node metastasis past the port hepatis, as well as distant mets, which would contraindicate resection. You also want to look for any multifocal liver disease because this is generally not amenable to resection. When you then move on to do the hepatic resection, you're looking for a negative margin as your goal. So a formal anatomic resection, a wedge resection, or segmental resection can be attempted. But again, you're looking for that negative margin.
Yeah. Again, it's another one that you don't need a biopsy for if the imaging is characteristic. However, if you based on your imaging, you think that it is a resectable lesion, you do need to perform a diagnostic laparoscopy prior to doing any resection. And then for resection, you know, the goal is an R0 resection, and that's going to depend on to what extent the cholangiocarcinoma affects liver. If it affects multifocal disease, well, this is not one of those cases, at least not on the boards, where you can be doing a transplant as in hepatocellular carcinoma. So that would be considered unresectable disease. Okay, how about extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma?
So for extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, the basic principle is still complete resection with negative margins. You're also going to do a regional lymphadenectomy. So for hilar carcinomas, in order to be resectable, you have to have the contralateral hemiliver intact in both the arterial and portal flow, as well as biliary drainage has to be uninvolved with the tumor. For these patients, you're going to reconstruct generally with a Roux-en-Y hepaticojejunostomy. And this differs in contrast to the distal cholangiocarcinoma, where you really can't do this, and so you're obligated to do a Whipple procedure.
Right. So extrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma, you need to resect and perform a biliary reconstruction. If it's a distal lesion, you'll likely need to do a Whipple. For those hilar ones, those can be very difficult, especially it's not always clear on imaging whether the contralateral liver is involved, but you need to have an uninvolved contralateral liver in order for that to be resectable. Okay, we've covered hepatocellular carcinoma, we've covered cholangiocarcinoma. We talked earlier briefly about gallbladder polyps, but let's talk about gallbladder cancer. Kevin, risk factors, gallbladder cancer.
So chronic inflammation, a porcelain gallbladder, polyps greater than 1 centimeter, a typhoid infection, and then primary sclerosing cholangitis and inflammatory bowel disease.
Okay, now you mentioned porcelain gallbladder. I'm going to bring that back up because it's a little bit controversial. I remember learning in med school that this is almost pathognomonic for gallbladder cancer if you had a patient with porcelain gallbladder. Is that still the case?
No, it's a much lower risk than was previously thought.
Yeah, so porcelain gallbladder does not equal gallbladder cancer. Some studies have shown that it's no increased risk. So if it is an increased risk for gallbladder cancer, it's likely a very small increased risk. So Wu, walk me through some principles of surgical management for gallbladder cancer. I'll tell you first, let's say you do a laparoscopic cholecystectomy for symptomatic cholelithiasis, and the pathology report comes back that there was a malignancy there. It's called gallbladder carcinoma. The pathologist is saying it's a T1A, which means it invades only the lamina propria. What do you want to do there?
Yeah, so look for that T1A invading only the lamina propria, because at that point, for a T1A tumor, a cholecystectomy alone is treatment enough. You're surgically complete at that point. You don't need any additional therapy. However, for T1B tumors and greater, so anything that invades the muscle layer or beyond, you're going to need the cholecystectomy as well as limited hepatic resection. Typically, you're going to do segments 4B and 5, as well as a portal lymphadenectomy.
Yep, exactly. So if it's a gallbladder cancer and it's T1A, only invades lamina propria, cholecystectomy, you're done. If it's T1B, it invades the muscle layer. So if you see that it invades any muscle layer there, you need to do a cholecystectomy, segment 4B, 5 resection, and lymph node, lymphadenectomy. More aggressive resections may be required for more advanced disease in order to obtain negative margins, but those are the classic ones that they're going to give you there. Okay, so that wraps up hepatobiliary. So let's jump right into our quick hits. So Kevin, you have a patient with colorectal cancer and an isolated liver metastasis. He receives neoadjuvant FOLFOX therapy, and restaging shows complete radiological response. What do you want to do with that site of the metastasis?
So even though the patient has no further evidence of colorectal metastasis to the liver, you still want to perform a hepatic resection, as a complete pathologic response is rare.
Right, exactly. So just because you can't see it on an imaging anymore doesn't mean it's not there. Okay, Woo. A patient has an asymptomatic cholelithiasis as well as a 5 millimeter gallbladder polyp.
So this patient has both stones and a 5 millimeter polyp. I would do a cholecystectomy because the risk of malignant transformation within gallbladder polyps has been linked to concurrent cholelithiasis.
Yep. So all those, you know, size cutoffs we mentioned earlier, the 6 millimeter, the 10 millimeter, and it being okay to watch or really not do anything with a polyp that would be 5 millimeters in any other circumstances. If they have concurrent stones, that is a marker for an increased risk of malignant transformation, and those patients do need a cholecystectomy. Kevin, what's the highest negative predictive value for choledocholithiasis?
So you look at the GGT, or the beta glutamyl transpeptidase.
Nailed it.
Normal GGT has a 97% negative predictive value.
Correct. Perfect. Okay. Woo. So you have a patient who had a prior gastric bypass, a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass, and now they present with signs and symptoms of choledocholithiasis. What do you want to do there?
So here, preoperatively, you would prefer to do an ERCP, but a traditional ERCP won't work due to the Roux-en-Y gastric bypass anatomy. So you would do a transgastric ERCP.
I have one caveat to that, which I saw in a question bank recently, is that if they do have the double balloon endoscopy where they can do an ERCP, that was actually in a question bank, you can consider that because they can reach the papilla by using the balloon technique with endoscopy.
Yeah, that's a good point. The key there is just knowing that if your patient's a bypass, you can't do a traditional ERCP. You can't get there. So either if you have advanced endoscopic that can kind of snake around and get there with a double balloon endoscopy, great. I think probably the more common thing is going to be the transgastric ERCP. Hepatocellular carcinoma found in a young patient with cirrhosis. What are you thinking of a young patient that has hepatocellular carcinoma?
So a young patient without cirrhosis, I'm thinking fibrolamellar variant. This has a better prognosis. Recurrence is common. And the marker for this is neurotensin.
Yep. So that's just one of those things. A young patient without cirrhosis develops hepatocellular carcinoma. It's likely the fibrolamellar variant. Should know that it does have a better prognosis. And the tumor marker for that one is neurotensin, which I don't have to tell you guys at this point, but tumor markers are highly testable. Okay, Kevin, incidental finding of adenocarcinoma invading the lamina propria layer of the gallbladder wall following a cholecystectomy.
No further treatment. Cholecystectomy is enough.
Okay, how about if it's invading the muscularis propria?
So cholecystectomy with a level 4 and 5 liver resection along with a portal node dissection.
Okay, so yep, resection, segment 4B and 5, portal lymphadenectomy. What are the tumor state or the T stages?
T1A and T1B.
Yeah, T1A is the lamina propria. T1B is the muscularis propria. So let's say you go back to the OR for your resection of your 4B, 5, and your lymphadenectomy. Do you need to excise? You'd previously done a laparoscopic cholecystectomy. Do you need to excise the port sites?
No.
Yeah, it used to be yes, but this has been a controversial area, but there's no benefit. So you do not need to excise the port sites when you go back. Okay. Woo. I'm just going to say isolated gastric varices. What do you think?
So splenic vein thrombosis secondary to pancreatitis.
Yep. So isolated gastric varices, most commonly caused by splenic vein thrombosis, most commonly caused by pancreatitis. What's the treatment for that?
Splenectomy.
We'll be curative for that. Kevin, last one. Patient's 4 weeks after hospitalization for a car accident with a liver laceration who is managed non-operatively. He now presents with an upper GI bleed. What's your first step?
This has definitely been on one of my exams. So you're going to do an EGD.
Okay. Yep. As with any upper GI bleed, usually the first step is EGD. So you do that and you see blood coming out of the duodenal papilla. What's the diagnosis?
Right. So this is a hepatic artery to biliary duct fistula causing the hemobilia.
And what's the treatment for that?
The treatment is angioembolization.
And that's one of those things that'll be tricky because they're going to ask you what the first step is. So you have somebody coming in with, you're going to know that they're going for hemobilia. They're going to have the car accident. They're going to have the liver laceration. They're going to have an upper GI bleed. And they're going to give you an option of either doing an EGD or an angioembolization. You may be thinking, well, I'm going to need an angioembolization for this. But the first step is an EGD. And then angioembolization for treatment. So it's a little bit of test gamesmanship, but you have to really think through how the question is asked.
And before we go into our last section of discussing liver resections, I just wanted to tell everyone there is a paper out there. If you go to PubMed and search a handy tool to teach segmental liver anatomy to surgical trainees. The lead author is Dr. Polly. This gives you a way of using your fist, your right fist, to denote the liver segments. And I find it really easy, and I learned this as like an R2, and I've used it ever since. So maybe go look that up and then listen to this next 30 seconds here as we go over our liver sections.
This will be our last of our quick hits, but Wu, what constitutes a right liver resection?
Segments 5, 6, 7, and 8.
5, 6, 7, 8. Kevin, left.
So this is your 2, 3, and 4.
Okay.
Plus or minus the caudate.
Okay, so Wu, left lateral segmentectomy.
2 and 3.
Kevin, extended right.
So for your extended right, you're going to have all the same ones as your right, which is 5, 6, 7, 8, but you're going to add in 4 there also.
Woo, extended left.
So you're going to start with the left, which is 2, 3, and 4, and then you're going to add on 5 and 8.
All right, that does it for Behind the Knife's hepatobiliary review. We'll see you next time.
Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want with PayPal, Venmo, PayLater, and all major cards so you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loan subject to approval in available locations. Cleveland is where the urban meets the outdoors, where cultural celebrations meet rabid sports fans meet the symphony, where nobody goes hungry and everybody loves music. Fueled by passion, we are the land for life. From rich history to hidden gems, the Legends of the Land podcast shares the real stories from real Clevelanders that shape the city. From iconic chefs to grassroots changemakers, sports heroes to creative visionaries, learn why living all out is in Cleveland's DNA. Go to thisisCLE.com/podcast.